talking about here? What's the general context?
It's moral reconstruction.
And your question about this is what?
Well, where does it get to the seeking that is probably there in the air? They seem to be more things that he likes rather than they seem to be here.
Don't separate the two. Say, remember, this is the sense of the better, the sense of amelioration of existing ills. It has a great deal to do with one's tastes, say, what one likes.
This
is the only way you can detect better from worse.
This seems to me like this is going to cause quite a problem because it's quite a subjective way of looking at things.
Subjective. Well, but remember, this isn't just taste that one is generating out of his psyche. It's taste that one is developing over against the objective conditions of reality. Remember, the interaction is another word in this system. An interaction doesn't just mean an interior dialogue with myself. It means my dialogue with the conditions of reality as they occur inside or outside myself. It's surely not just a matter of subject invention. Here he's talking about theories of fixed ends. And then he's calling for a more empirical view than one would hold who has a concept of a summa bona, one supreme end. And he says, while there's not a single end, there are seemingly more empirical view and say that while there is not a single end, there also are not as many as there are specific situations that require mediation. But there are a number of such natural goods, health, wealth, honor, or good name, friendship, aesthetic appreciation, or even such moral goods as justice, temperance, benevolence, and so forth.
I can see this moral goods, natural goods, and how.
What or who is to decide the right of way when these ends conflict with one another, as they are sure to do? Casualty? Casualty? Shall we have recourse to what Bentham called the arbitrary preference, this or that person for this or that end? See, actually, he's not siding with these at the moment. He's opposing what happens when you have elevated a group of fixed ends. And you discover that these ends collide. So, for instance, health and friendship. Well, like I go by to 1 o'clock in the morning and I find a friend who has a flat tire. But I have a weak heart. And he stops me and wants to borrow my tire implement. I'm recounting a situation that occurred to me just the night before last. I don't have a weak heart, but if I had, then the demands of friendship and the demands of health really collide. What are you going to do? Just flip a coin? So that he's not really siding with these absolute ends. He's only posing the issue as to how complex ethical decisions or moral decisions can be, and how people who try to reduce the complexity by just falling into the arms of kind of pre-established morality, a concept of fixed ends, don't really resolve the complexity. They intensify it. They put themselves in this kind of a contradictory situation. Yeah. Well, and yes, you see, what are you going to do with it? With the Ten Commandments, aren't they fixed? Well, yes and no. Nobody's in doubt about what it means. When you say, thou shalt not commit adultery, although when you say honor your father and your mother, this has something that is not particularly fixed about it. For instance, a child at age 5 is one basis for honoring his father and his mother. At age 25, another basis. And he has to learn to accommodate the connotation of honor to the maturing situation. But even with something that looks so fixed as the seventh commandment, thou shalt not commit adultery, Jesus did a real piece of Dewey instrumentalism with that commandment. It's not as fixed in the same way you think it is. It has a subtlety in it that she requires some attention, like you can look upon a woman who lusts. In his heart already. Well, that's not quite as formalistic, not quite as easy to appraise. And that was exactly Jesus' point with the law. That you think, he says to Jesus, you think you have arrived at the principle of security in the world by following the law. I show you that in, by this procedure, you're only inviting increased anxieties, because you will never know when you have really kept it. Yes?
What about the honor of the Jewish, of the general term?
Honor. Yes, the honor has the beautiful ethical ability to be flexible. So you don't know what honor means in the abstract. You only know what honor means in some concrete situation. So honor thy father and thy mother, yes, but to whom are you talking? To a five-year-old? Well, that means one thing. You obey at all times and don't say a haughty thing. Not calculated to disintegrate your parent. But at age 25, he shows that kind of advice, which is so what do you say? The Ten Commandments are for children? No, you rephrase the meaning of honor. And maybe you... Well, I've got to consult Paul Mays on this. He's a specialist in work with older people. Some people that think honor means, well, we spend $25 every month to help folks out. That might be a way to dishonor. But I agree, you have to answer that for yourself. My point is that the fact that honor is so flexible is what makes it a defined ethical principle. And if you want the ultimate word on this, you should read Paul Tillich's essay. We'll get into this when we talk about values and responsibility. Tillich's essay called entitled The Transmoral Conscience. It appears in his collection, The Protestant Era. Where he takes Paul's lesson. Paul says the whole law is reducible to one word, love. How do you love? That's just why the whole law is reducible to one word. It throws the burden of discernment upon you. Whereas a legalistic ethic that has every little thing covered takes the burden of responsibility off you and then throws the question over whether this is really an ethical principle. An ethic that takes the burden of responsibility off you is not a proper ethic. But the ethic of love, or the ethic of honor, or the ethic of the situational ethic of duty, or the instrumental ethic, puts the burden on you. It is not made up of fixed principles. It is made up of flexible principles that make it possible for you to be responsible in incremental situations, growing situations. The other problem, I don't mean to settle these, but only to enter into dialogue. Well, let's go on with Whitehead then. You know how influential Whitehead has been in American philosophy? As a matter of fact, I was just handed along the students here a tape of a lecture by the president of Rutgers University on theism, which is structured by Whiteheadian philosophy. But probably the most typically American theology has been influenced by the Whitehead point of view. And it began, in a way, in reaction to what was called John Dewey's naturalistic humanism. And it began with Henry Nelson Wyman. You know him? Teached at the University of Chicago, then went to the University of Houston, and I believe is now at the University of Southern Illinois. By the use of the Whitehead philosophy, Henry Nelson Wyman set up an alternative to Dewey's, what he called Dewey's naturalistic humanism. And then Harold Kwok, one time dean of Drew Theological Seminary, once characterized Henry Nelson Wyman's position as evangelical naturalism. Not naturalistic humanism, but evangelical naturalism. That is to say, it is a naturalism, just like Dewey, based on many of the same motifs. But it isn't simply humanistic, it is theistic. And Whitehead's metaphysics is a theistic naturalism, which has given rise to a whole strain in American theology that is probably the most typical American, most indigenous American theology, that nobody else in the world knew of it until Americans brought their attention to it. And cite in this, I think I've already cited some of the major figures in this school. Charles Hartshorne, I suppose, is the most conspicuous, was at Chicago, went to Emory, and is now at the University of Texas, I believe. And Daniel Day Williams is probably the most widely accepted theological representative of this school. Was at Chicago, is now at Union. And two men at Chicago remain in this tradition, Bernard Groomer and Bernard Malin. It's just come out with a big book titled The Realities of Faith. And one of the younger, two of the younger representatives who promised to be the most vigorous and effective representatives are Schubert Ogden and Hugh Perkins and John Cobb at Claremont Methodist Seminary there. Now, what is there about Whitehead that has made him so important to this tradition and the whole theological situation about him? Let me move into this rather slowly by telling you something about Whitehead. It's very impressive that almost exactly exemplifies Plato's recommendation for responsible intellectual procedure in life. You know, Plato advised young men to study, do nothing but study, and to exercise too. Until age 50, then emerge in the public life after you're prepared to say something significant. Nobody's following that advice. Whitehead seems to follow almost to the date. You know, he was born in 1861. And he didn't really emerge into public life until 1911, when he became a fellow of Trinity College in Cambridge, England. Cambridge University. He was there for 4 years, and in 1914, he moved to the University of London, where he was lecturer in mathematics and mechanics. And then in 1924, 10 years later, he came to Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts, as professor of philosophy, and there he really made himself famous in this period from 1924 to 1938. But look, he was 63 years old already. But he prepared himself to say something significant, and now the world listens to it. The literature of Whitehead falls into clearly defined periods, which manifest his movement from his early epistemological concerns to his later mature metaphysical concerns. Like are entitled the Principles of Natural Knowledge. And say before this time, he enriched the great Principia Mathematica with Bertrand Russell. And his concept of nature. Then he moved into metaphysics, and this corresponds to his more precise philosophical period, beginning at Harvard University. And the first important book in this series was his Science and the Modern World. It was written in 1925, published in 1926. And the second important work was Resistance and the Making, which made explicit some of the implicit theological values of his work. This is kind of those things in paperback, most of the stuff in paperback that came out in 1927. Then his great work, for which he has established himself as a philosopher, is Process and Reality, which was a gift of lectures in about 1929. Then following his two very fascinating works with a real literary charm, but drawing on the logical, metaphysical rigor of Process of Reality, are his Adventures of Ideas in about 1933, and then the thing I recommend to you, Modes of Thought, which came out in 1938. Now, the movement from this epistemological phase to the metaphysical phase is really characterized as a movement from mathematics to romanticism. Or from logic to poetry. Or from the concept of nature to a revision of that concept in a concept of organicism. This is an organismic philosophy, not just a naturalism in the ordinary sense, but an organismic philosophy. So that in this later point of view, we can say the grains of sand on the beach love each other, and feel that he's making a rigorous, a philosophically rigorous statement. It sounds like romanticism. Grains of sand on the beach love each other. That's a philosophically rigorous system, rigorous statement, if you see it within his system. And this movement from nature to organicism, or from logic, in the classical sense virtually, or in a very mathematical sense, to metaphysics, or romanticism, or poetry, can be defined in terms like these. In this period, he was interested, as natural sciences are, in seeing, in correlating the particulars into a whole. Moving from particulars to universals. In this later phase, he was interested in seeing particulars in the light of the whole, moving to particulars from the standpoint of the whole, so that actually the word that Alan was the South African premier one time, the word holism somewhat applies to this metaphysics of the later Whitehead. Later Whitehead, if you know him, one remember. Now, what's at stake in this philosophy in relation to, let us say, the history of philosophy in general? So this organismic metaphysics of Whitehead stands over against the more classical positions of scholasticism and idealism in some significant ways. First of all, reference to idealism. according to Whitehead, there is some idealism in process philosophy. So, for instance, he's very fond of Plato, arch idealist, and he's very fond of Leibniz. He says Plato, that all history of philosophy is a footnote to Plato. And he's fond of Leibniz because Leibniz brought Plato's geometry up to date. And there's a great deal of mathematics in the background of this tradition. There's some idealism in process philosophy, and there's some process in all idealism. So the arch-idealist, Hegel, you saw the process element in Hegel emerge in Marxism. There's a dynamic, a dialectic in history that's already again in the process going on. As to scholasticism, however, you can scarcely say there's any process in scholasticism. Scholasticism being the philosophy characteristic of the Middle Ages and still in the background of modern Roman Catholicism. This is the most severely structural philosophy, even though it does have within it, and this is the sort of thing that contemporary scholastics point out most eagerly, it does have within it what is called a dynamic ontology. That is to say, every segment of being has a potentiality that actualizes itself so that the dynamic process of movement from potentiality to actuality is going on in every little segment of being, and that looks like process, but actually this potentiality never gets out of its pre-established box. In process philosophy, you never make a diagram that's all closed in like this. That's of the essence of scholasticism, of structural thinking. But process philosophy, always, reality is always open at both ends. For instance, scholasticism draws most of its analogies from the sort of thing you see happening out here, acorns becoming oaks. An acorn is a potential oak. Think of all the process that's going on with this little acorn, the first thing open at the end of a little red shoot that eventually becomes a giant. Oh, tremendous process, yes, but it's not process in Whitehead's sense, because the acorn can only become an oak. It's a tremendous limitation. All boxed in by openness in that little acorn. That's scholasticism. Dynamic is all get out, but within this severely structural limitation. But the thing about this philosophy has against both idealism and scholasticism is its hierarchical structure, especially as between nature and value. According to both idealism and scholasticism, nature is the realm of science and value is the realm of religion. Something religious about value, something scientific about nature, and this hierarchy is something that can't really be overbridged, merged. That value is always something permanent and unchanging, and nature is something in process and changing, temporal, not eternal. Now look what process philosophy does to that. It absolutely erases this hierarchical structure, and it says there is something religious about nature, and there is something scientific about value, or value, or about science. Now I'm not going to explicate that any further, but you'll see how that's so. As the system unfolds, there's nothing process philosophy affords more than hierarchies and bifurcations. Now, where did this philosophy get its incentive for overcoming these bifurcations in classical philosophical systems? You know that word bifurcation is intended? I suppose I insult you by asking you, but I don't think I knew it. I was in Burton Seminary, at least, draw, and I used to draw in presence of a big word and not really know what it means. You can at least know it by.
Furta is the Latin word for fort. I bet you know that. As we did, you forgot it. And we can all foreshed. What's that? In French, fort, and furta. Well, whatever you let reality fork, split apart, that makes process philosophy nervous. Because it's an organism, an organismic philosophy, where things have to be seen together. And here in practical systems, both idealism and scholasticism, we have a fulca, a wide fulca, a forking apart of reality that that process philosophy needs to overcome. Now, where does it get the incentive for doing it? Just as in Dewey, the incentive has come from science. To me, this is the really vulnerable kind of process philosophy, that it has taken the incentive, the model for philosophical revolution from the natural science. And while there's a great deal of talk about history in this system, the meaning of history is always somehow embraced in the categories of the natural science, even though these categories are the most illuminated, let's say the most up-to-date, post-Newtonian, anti-Newtonian science. Two major discoveries in the new science, which have led to the so-called new physics, or quantum physics. First of all, radioactivity. We know since the discovery of radioactivity, science knows that reality is not made up of all kinds of little indivisible pellets. Reality is made up of whirling masses of energy. Van Gogh had a real intuition of this when he painted his landscapes. Not little indivisible pellets, but whirling masses of energy. Furthermore, in relativism of the Einsteinian variety, it is now known, because of relativism, that reality is not made up of unchanging, immovable spaces. You know, customarily one gets the impression that he stands in a very stable space, and from this space he can measure other spaces, even if these other spaces are moving. As long as he's standing in a stable space, at rest, he can measure all rest of reality. But relativity has made it clear that there is no such stable resting point anywhere from which to measure anything else. And if we're going to measure, we have to take into our calculation the fact that we are moving, just as the object we're measuring is moving. Standing on the railroad tracks down here, by the railroad tracks, and you see the people snow by. What power, what speed? Maybe you haven't so much as heard whether there be a PV snow. But you say, that train is really going fast. Then someone comes up and whispers in your ear, you know how fast you're going. I mean, considering the spin of the earth. And that speed, when you're measuring the speed of something outside yourself, that speed has to be taken into consideration. This is relativity. There's no resting place anywhere in reality. And it's on the basis of these insights into new science that the old structural way of looking at reality has been abandoned. Now then, how can a philosopher, considering the tremendous revolutions that have occurred in our thinking in recent years, how can a philosopher go on using the same words that traditional philosophy uses? Well, that's a problem. And Whitehead's answer to that is he cannot. If he does, he commits the fallacy of the perfect dictionary. So we find really queer words. This is what's going to give us our biggest problem. Really queer words like prehension. Well, you've heard of comprehension, but have you heard of prehension? Concretion, impression. Well, Whitehead has been an inventor of words. Simply because he doesn't believe it's possible to or advisable to put new wine in old wineskins. We find that we're found with a vengeance that you think Whitehead is complicated metric, and then wait for them to get into Heidegger. Says Heidegger, of course, has this advantage with Americans that he invents these perfect German words, but then an English translator find ordinary English equivalent for these perfectly complicated, sophisticated German inventions in a way tend to bump the edge of the higher discovery. In any case, you wouldn't expect a philosophical innovator to express his point of view in a traditional language. If you did, then you would be asking him to commit what Whitehead calls a fallacy in the perfect dictionary. Well, let's move ahead with some of these terms. First, the term that characterizes the philosophy process. What's this mean? Now, what significance does this have in the philosophy? It has this significance that there is in actuality, that actuality is already one of Whitehead's terms, there is his definition, but we'll only get to it later. In actuality, there is nothing permanent. That is to say, nothing static. Now remember, I said in actuality. There are some permanent things in Whitehead, but nowhere in actuality. Where in the world is, where else is there? It's not an actuality. Now, in order to do justice to this word process, a great variety of terms are used in the Whitehead system, such as change, very important term, but has the same kind of, computation in modern philosophy as Schwab had for Aristotle. Except, just like Dewey, when Whitehead hears the word change, he doesn't weep. He rejoices, because anybody who's informed by empirical methodology knows that you only get knowledge when something changes. Everything just remains the same. It's boring, but when something changes, you get ideas. See things in relation, in dynamic interchange, then you get ideas, you get increments. So, for instance, if you say of a person whom you haven't seen for a long time, you suddenly see him again, you say, he's changed. Well, that's not the inflection Whitehead would give. Whitehead would say, he's changed. That the inflection is everything there. It's important to change. Charles Hartshorne, incidentally, who's the famous process philosopher in America, is also an amateur ornithologist. And back in 1954, made a report to the Ornithological Society. He discovered something about birds that bird lovers, without process philosophy, hadn't really discovered. He discovered that birds that have a monotonous song don't sing much. I mean, they have long pauses between their songs. But birds that have an interesting song sing all the time. Now, why is that? His analysis was that a monotonous song isn't interesting, therefore you forget it. And these birds, the long pauses between their notes, have been a lapse of memory. They've forgotten it. The same thing you see is true about history. History isn't just everything that's happened. History is the things that have happened that you remember. But you only remember the things that have been really momentous, that have been interesting. For the rest, you have a lapse of memory. And that's as it should be. Change, variety, interest. What contributes to the process. Another word is the word time. For temporalistic philosophy is called, sometimes called epochalism, where the emphasis is not placed upon spaces, but upon time. So the word again comes into prominence here too, not just spaces, can be marked off, but happenings.
that can be dated. Event, as a matter of fact, in this process of optics is characteristic of all reality. Here's the point at which Heidegger and Whitehead see eye to eye. What they mean the same, I'm not quite sure. Hubert Ockham, I think I told you this right now, in Basel, Germany, working on this very problem. The extent to which Heidegger and Whitehead see eye to eye. And here's one of the very important points. All reality has the characteristic of events. Not just human history, but these trees are happening. They're eventful. They're in the process of reality. Therefore, their life, their reality, has to be characterized as event, occurrence. So that all reality, says Whitehead, has a historic character. Personally, I'm not impressed by that. I don't know whether I'm going to get around in this semester to show why. But it seems to me historic. It doesn't have to do with just current. It has to do with current, significant current. But not just significant in Whitehead's sense. Everything is significant for Whitehead, but humanly significant. Let's say significant in the sense that his consciousness confers upon human life a supportive meaning. Another word is relation. In a way, Whitehead and Russell, who worked with Russell, who worked together in the younger years, so much of mathematics, saw eye to eye on this. Old classical philosophies were what they called term philosophy, just as we call them in science, you know, had reality all broken up into metaphysical particles. So classical philosophy thought in terms, whereas process philosophy thinks in terms of relations. One might say relations between terms, but they don't say that because, as a matter of fact, they can draw a diagram like this, simply of relations, and then trace all the terms. And that's reality. Not relations between terms, not relations between terms, but just relations.
Very important for anthropology. God were not an object to which you relate. What if God were relation? What if you were not a thing that relates to other things, but a relation? See, the knowledge then between the knowledge of the difference between a term and a relation would be pretty crucial to the way you conduct your life, wouldn't it? Not that the something that relates, your relation. So get at it. Stop just protecting the something. Get relating. There's tremendous value for human life, if it's true. Then organism is another word that's related to this general connotation of process. And it seems to mean that everything influences everything else. We can already see that notion of relation. Everything is influenced and then it is influenced by everything else. Organism. So, for instance, this doesn't just have a biological connotation. You are an organism, that is to say, you breathe, or you have nerves. No, it means more like what Paul Cockwith meant when he said the church is the body of Christ, an organism. Many members, one body. Therefore, all the members are related to each other. That's what Methodism means by being a connectional system. I know it's Pauline. But connection, of course, in this organismic sense that we all relate to everybody else. Everything in reality, I shouldn't personalize it, although this has been called a personalistic physics, the system of why that has been called a personalistic physics. I don't mean to just limit the relationship. The person is everything. In reality, everywhere, is influencing, is related to, interrelated to everything else. Well, this leads to the word experience. Now, experience is a continuum in which there are no dichotomies, such as between a mind and a body so familiar to Cartesian philosophy. Cartesianism is still, contemporary philosophy is still fighting Cartesianism, still trying to eradicate it, not so much from philosophy as from common sense attitudes. People in general that resist their appropriation of best insights in philosophy. Experience is a continuum in which there are no hierarchies, no dichotomies. Therefore, this philosophy is a very democratic philosophy. There are no hierarchies. Nobody is in a position of power over anybody else. We all need each other. Relationalism, organism. And it's a kind of eschatology, you know, in the old sense that it is open for the future. Experience is always open for the future, never closed. Also open toward the past. If it weren't, it would have a new dichotomy. I'll point that out. The real blow is some kind of attitudes for history. It's always be open to the past as well as to the future, otherwise you can introduce dichotomy. You might even have the dichotomy between the past and the present, or past and future. Any more than you have a dichotomy between mind and body. The dichotomy between God and man, that has to go. No dichotomy. Experience is a continuum. Experience is characteristic of the process. And one of the main characteristics, there's a word of its own, one of the main characteristics of this experiential process is its incremental characteristic. Experience is incremental. Now, what does that mean? Well, I'm sure you know, like some time, concept of time in this view. Time is not something that dwindles away. Time is something that gathers up. Very interesting, for instance, in relation to the hymn Abide with Thee. That's called in that. Change and decay is all around I see. Woe thou who changes not, abide with thee. Well, that second line doesn't impress me. I like it at all. It's enough for him to say change and decay, even decay. In all around I see that's it. That's the end. You don't need to go on and say, oh, thou who changes not. Because the finest thing about experience is its incremental character, how it sheds the inadequate and collects more and more adequacy. I've already been prepared for this in doing. But the basis for this in traditional thought, in history of thought, was very clearly defined. Because for most of the history of Western thought, it tends to be that causes are greater than effects. Aristotle and Aquinas, in particular, made a great thing of this. Causes are greater than effects in a way you can see that. For instance, you throw a ball, this tremendous causative power, and you watch the ball fall to the ground and stop. Well, the effect is disproportionate, really, to the magnificent cause that has projected the ball, and the Descartes built his ontological argument for the existence of God. It's not properly an ontological argument, but a causal argument, that he said, I have the idea of God. I could have caused such an idea, such an effect. There must be a greater cause. God himself must have caused such an effect as an idea of God. Because the cause is greater than the effect. Yes, but I'm here to tell you that there's tradition in philosophy that might just attribute that idea of God to a fragment of undigested potato in Descartes. That's such a beautiful idea. The idea of God could be caused by something less, not something greater. And the preparation for that position came through Galileo, who said, causes equal, that's
effects. And how did he find that out? One day he threw a ball, and it didn't stop. Why? Because it landed on ice. And there was no resistance to it, no friction. And he discovered that if you could reduce all resistance to projected objects, they would continue on in the item, the way now our projectiles in outer space just go on and on by inertia without resistance. Causes are equal to effects. And that prepared the way for Darwin, who was able to say effects really are greater than causes. Because look, you once, your forebears were worms. Don't believe it? Look at the book of Job, where Job says, I said to the worm, thou art my mother. That's good scripture basis for Darwin. Our beginnings were really very minor. They are our causes, but look, we're the effects. We're greater than the causes. That's what Darwin pointed out. In an evolutionary system of reality, goes even beyond Galileo, effects are greater than causes. And that's precisely what Whitehead did. We experience is incremental. It's getting bigger and bigger. And then another word that is related to this is the word universe, which simply specifies the total character of reality. Reality is one relational complex, hence universe. It's meaning in this very serious. Reality is one relational complex underlying everything, past, present, and future, overcoming all hierarchical splits. Now then, the third big category is creativity. This is what Whitehead calls the principle of novelty in reality, which is kind of beyond logical explanation for it, the inference that occurs in experience. Creativity is the principle of novelty. That is to say, because of creativity, something new is constantly being born out of the old. Then if you know some other philosophies that use the word emergence, Whitehead doesn't like the word emergence because there's too much of a split. Let's say as if you cast off the old, you become something different, gone beyond. No. Creativity is delivering the new from the old, hence no dichotomy between old and new. And also, if you're familiar with the word creation, you will know that creativity doesn't mean what creation does, because creation implies ex nihilo. You know, create, you know, making something without reference to anything else. That's an act of creation. Whereas creativity is simply a principle of novelty, which accounts for how what is emerges into something new. Well, which accounts for how what is old becomes ever newer incrementally. Yes?
I don't understand how you can say this does away with all dichotomy, because it seems like if you really do away with all dichotomy, there could be really nothing new. There could be really no change at all. How are you going to distinguish between something past or old and something that is old?
Well, of course, you've got a very good point. But when I describe how this happens, you'll see that the reason there's no dichotomy is that whatever is left of the old that is made possible the new dies. So it's not there to dichotomize with. It dies. It has no status in reality, in actuality.
Why is death
then?
Assume
the dichotomy
is
character too. Except that death death is a noble principle here. It's not over against life. It's the possibility of life. You die, one dies. See, it's like crucifixion and resurrection. No dichotomy there. Hopewell points out. See, how you hyphenate crucifixion and resurrection.
How do you want to choose the principle?
That I'll show you. The principles do not have the status of actuality, but they have a status.
In actuality?
No.
Yeah, life is related for
you. Yeah, that's right. The principle.
No dichotomy in actuality.
That's right. No dichotomy in actuality. But whatever principles are, they are not dichotomized. As you'll see, they're organismically related to actuality. I'll show you that in just a minute. You see now. The principle of creativity enjoys a process, and here comes probably the most unique term in the system, called prehension. The process of creativity is called prehension. And prehension has two aspects, I think. One is called feeling. And here we begin to get a rather anthropomorphic, romantic language for a very rigorous concept. Feeling, however, has two characteristics. You know anything about Heidegger, Pokemon, and her musical circle? It has an emotional and a conceptual connotation. Now, the emotional connotation has to do with physical selectivity. Feeling embraces physical selectivity. That is to say, in an act, in a moment of prehension, a great variety of experiences are prehended into one experience. A great variety of experiences creatively, incrementally unified for the future. That's called prehension, and it takes place by feeling, which has an emotional characteristic of selectivity, but sheer physical selectivity. Not one decides what from the past will become my present. It depends on how things feel. But it also depends on something conceptual, that is to say, on how you feel about it. So you see, in feeling, you have this interplay of how things feel and how you feel about them, which determine the way in which the past will be gathered up together in my experience moving toward the future. So, well, we have emotional feeling, physical selectivity, we also have conceptual feeling, that is to say, intellectual selectivity. And remember that anything you can say of anything can be said of everything. So that I'm not now just talking about how men live, I'm talking about how all reality proceeds. You can cut off a piece of reality anywhere, the most sluggish to the most vibrant. Like from a piece of iron to the feather of a bird. It has the same structure. Prehension is constantly going on. This is what counts for the process that's going on in that. So that this notion of feeling is not just a conscious process. Not, it may or may not be a conscious process. Let me add before I get your problem there, one kind of study. Add one more. This prehension is also made up of contrapressants. Now, contrapressants have two connotations. It comes from a process in which reality is growing together, incrementally.
Growing,
yes, for the future, but together in ever new patterns of unification. On present, constantly going on through this process of pre-entry. But also has the notion of concrete. Remember, this is what White had believed differentiated his method from traditional methods. Traditional logics were abstract because they took particulars and unified them. Whereas he believes his is concrete because from some principle of unity, he assembles particulars. This is what he means by concrete, as over against abstract, and it occurs under the conditions of pre-entry. Pre-entry can be called a mode of understanding. But you see, now we have no bifurcation between epistemology and metaphysics. It's a mode of understanding which is the very characteristic of reality itself. Now,
I just wondered if that's a very important way to illustrate this aspect of feeling. There's some illustrations that can bring those two aspects together. Or you said at the end that it's unconscious sometimes, so I put my hand down and I wasn't sure that what is unconscious you can illustrate.
Yes, well, I would say our best illustrations are related to our own experience. But in Whitehead's system, that has a particular advantage because our own experience is no different from experience anywhere else. It's no different from God's experience, let alone an animal's or a plant's or a mineral's experience. Experience is the same. So if we knew what feeling meant for us, we'd know what it meant for a plant. And logically, that is. Now,
emotional feelings.
Well, how do you decide between one thing and another? You analyze that. Then you realize that at least these ingredients are present. How does it feel to me? How does it feel to me? Remember that White is also aware of biology, about the biological sciences too, and the sort of thing we discussed in Dewey, this reactivity that is so characteristic of natural relations, in relation to factually, perceptually. That's one ingredient in what could occur in the next step in reality. But another ingredient, how do I feel about it? To say, I'm not just a victim of actual relations, I stand in judgment over them too. There's some conceptual, therefore intellectual. Now, that's the way nature moves, the way God moves, the way man moves. Why does this come?
I don't know.
You're
talking in terms of selecting out of a group of objects. You do your diagram later, you're making a selection of things together. I can understand a little better. It's just a selection between two things.
Yeah.
You know, you have a choice. The feeling goes into making a selection.
Yeah.
When you're drawing, certainly drawing down the board of terms.
Yes, well, that's of course why it has to be said that this can be unconscious too, because look at what's happening to us now. All the, you stop and reflect on all the factors that are playing upon us at this moment. Well, you can isolate one or two and make them the focus of your decision, but in a way you almost have to interrupt the process to do that. But at the same time, just because we are not consciously interrupting the process doesn't mean that we are not undergoing a dynamic process of selectivity every minute, every instant. Remember, I'm saying about contrasting. This is a specialized word you see over and over in the Whitehead literature, but it has two related connotations. One, this sense of growing together that you already illustrated in this pretty intensive experience, but also the
connotation of opposite of abstraction, opposite of abstractness. Abstractness here being defined as collecting particulars under some kind of universal judgment. Here, rather, the universal judgment precedes your relationship to the particulars and provides you a basis for organization, a basis for the world together. Now, but I have to go on and tell you where this universal comes in, because I haven't yet indicated that. See, not everything that enters into prehension has come out of the past or out of actuality. Yes.
Is this concrete principle what affects how things feel to you? Or
no.
Or your feeling, your selectivity or something?
No. It's just a description of a total experience that includes how things feel. Includes emotional feeling.
Is there any principle or anything that decides for you how things feel, or is it purely a
You see, yes, you have your own initiative. You can decide how you feel about things, but what decides how things feel? What are they? They have their own initiative. They have their own independence to impress themselves upon you. How they feel depends on them. How they feel you depends on them.
So, would this concreteness be a principle outside of the mind of initiative? That it brings things together? Or
not at all. You see, the concreteness here is an abstract principle which defines what's going on in experience. And what goes on in experience embraces all these factors of the way things feel and the way I feel about them. So, it's a generic term, actually, descriptive of the whole experience of growth. Yes.
My future, and I myself am an actual occasion. And God
is an actual occasion. God is actual in the dimensional sense. Now, I should also say that these actual occasions are under the influence of an ideal realm called eternal objects. These are not actual, but they are there ideally. Eternal objects, like Plato's realm of ideas, except for Plato, the ideas were the actual, and the actual was the apparent. But for Whitehead, the realm of ideas is only potential. It enjoys the status of possibility, not actuality. Potentiality, not reality. Ideality, not reality. And these eternal objects, this hierarchy of all possible, is constantly brought to bear upon the process of prehension, providing perspective which adds to emotional and conceptual feeling, which informs emotional and conceptual feeling, so that we decide about our future, not just in the light of the past, but in the light of what kind of, what it calls the impression upon our presence of this realm of eternal objects. Now, in the next session, I'll have to go into detail about the meaning of an actual occasion and the meaning of eternal objects and how they correlate. And then, the really big thing in the system, the principle of concretion, which is quite a name for God, and how the whole universe coheres by virtue of the existence of God, who is called primordial or actual occasion, and who has the responsibility for holding all these priorities in his attention and for bringing them to bear upon our process, and whose very being is at stake because he is an actual occasion who comes over what is there in the process. His very being is at stake in the way he presents our decision.